Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC. Coming up tomorrow, is there a dangerous bubble in municipal bonds, or is that just anti-government political propaganda? And should states be allowed to declare bankruptcy to renege on their pension obligations? The Republican House is holding hearings on both those questions today. We'll get reaction tomorrow here on The Brian Lehrer Show. By the way, one correction to something I said just before the break. The three controversial provisions of the Patriot Act are not suspended as a result of this vote in the House. They will expire at the end of the month as a result of the vote, unless Congress revisits it. Now, just when you thought you knew everything bad there was to know about Scientology, the investigative reporter Lawrence Wright has some new revelations in this week's New Yorker. He reports mostly through the story of the Oscar-winning filmmaker Paul Haggis, who in 2006 became the first screenwriter to write two Best Film Oscar winners back-to-back, Million Dollar Baby, directed by Clint Eastwood, and Crash, which he directed himself. For Crash, he won Academy Awards for Best Picture and Best Original Screenplay. Now, Haggis was a devoted Scientologist for years, but then left the religion and had a lot to say about it. I spoke to Lawrence Wright yesterday and asked him why Paul Haggis, of all people, got drawn into Scientology and stayed with it as long as he did.
People get a lot out of Scientology, you know, especially, I think, he was typical of a lot of young, ambitious people who streamed into Hollywood in the 70s and 80s, who many of them had dropped out of school. They didn't have very much formal education, and suddenly they're given something that proposes to allow them to master all of this.
And Haggis got very high up, you write, in Scientology practice. What does that mean?
Well, there's a kind of base camp for Scientology, which is called CLEAR. It's the entry level. You go in, you take courses, you get auditing, and the point is to clear away the emotionally troubling events of your life, not just this life, but maybe past lives as well. And then you attest to a level that's called CLEAR. After that, there are other levels that are called operating thetans. And they go all the way up now to operating Thetan 8. When Paul was in the church, 7 was the highest level, and he attained that.
Which means what?
Well, if you read the Scientology literature, becoming an operating Thetan means that you can operate on events outside of yourself by mental exercises. And
they measure it in some way?
It's self-measured. When you become an operating Thetan, you move into a level where there's a lot of what's called self-auditing. And the auditing process is one of the most intriguing features of Scientology. They use something called an E-meter, which when Paul first joined the church, they were empty soup cans that you would hold in each hand and connected to a meter, and a small amount of electrical current runs through there. It's indetectable, but essentially it resembles to some extent a polygraph, although it doesn't measure perspiration or pulse rate, but galvanic skin response. Although the church claims that what the E-meter actually measures is your thoughts. They say that thoughts have a small amount of mass. And Paul found that, you know, that the E-meter was very responsive, that it seemed to be spookily able through his auditing process to discover things that were frightening to him or emotionally charged. So at that level, he felt that he was getting quite a lot out of the church.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with my guest Lawrence Wright, his article in The New Yorker this week about the Church of Scientology, and particularly focusing on the experiences of the director and screenwriter Paul Haggis. So as the revelations about the upper levels of Scientology grew increasingly more and more bizarre, what kept somebody like Paul Haggis involved?
And, you know, that's really why I got into the story, Brian. I mean, why, you know, what is it? Because this is such a stigmatized religion. To affiliate yourself with it, especially if you're a notable person like Paul became, you sacrifice something. And by the time that he got into this upper level of Scientology, where some of their theological secrets are revealed, he had already invested a lot of money in it, a lot of time. His wife was deeply engaged in it. His sister was a part of the clergy. He had children that were going to Scientology school. Many of his friends were Scientologists. He worked with Scientologists. He was a part of the community. He had a strong incentive to stay in the community and to believe it.
L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology, is viewed in our society, I think, either as a huge fraud or, by those involved, the most important mind in the world. Where does the actual truth exist between those poles, in your opinion, after doing this research?
He obviously exaggerated his life. He was a very imaginative person. He may have more words in print than any other human being. So he was constantly spilling out pulp fiction and sci-fi novels and so on. And he maybe had a little bit of difficulty with allegiance to the truth where his own life is concerned. He had these extravagant stories about his early travels, about his war record. And when looked at, when you look at the record, you see that underneath this inflated imaginary life, there is a real life that parallels it, but not so grandly. So he really was a very interesting man. But he must not have thought that himself. That's a part of his. One reads the difference between these two men, the imaginary Ron Hubbard and the real one, with a kind of sadness, because you think there really is a very intriguing, creative individual under all this.
Maybe the most troubling part of your article is your description of something called the SEA organization, S-E-A, which the FBI was or is investigating for slave labor. What is the SEA organization?
At one point, Ron Hubbard had a fleet of ocean-going vessels, three of them. And he had a crew that he picked, essentially teenagers. And they were going all over the world, mainly in the Mediterranean. These young people, he called the SEA organization.
When was this?
This was in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And he was at sea for a considerable period of time. And eventually this group became the sort of clergy in the church. And they manage the many churches and missions around the world. And they form a cadre. They're about 5,000 strong. They wear naval uniforms. They sign commitments for 1 billion years of service, because Scientologists believe that you're incarnated through many different lifetimes. So they sign on for it's an extraordinary level of commitment, and they're paid about $50 a week. They live in different churches and missions, and also at a base in Hemet, California, which is one of the main centers of the SEA organization.
And these stories of mental and physical abuse, where do they come from? How verified are they?
They center on the Gold Base, which is a Sea Org compound 80 miles southeast of Los Angeles in Hemet, California, which until recently was a secret location unknown to many Scientologists. It's a 500-acre compound surrounded by a security fence, motion sensors, security guards. It's, you know, very well protected. People are not allowed to freely come and go.
But again, what were the things or alleged things that got the FBI on their tail?
People aren't permitted to freely go and come to this base. And on, I talked to Gary Moorhead, who was the head of the Scientology security detail, and he said that he developed something called a blow drill. When people tried to flee the base, he and his security people would track them down. And over the 13 years that he was there, he said, they dragged back more than 100 people, most of them using psychological or emotional or spiritual arguments, but when that failed, they would physically bring them back. In addition, I should say, Brian, they have something called the hole on the goal base, where people are sentenced to a kind of re-education. And some people have been in that kind of confinement for as long as a decade. I do want to acknowledge the fact that the church doesn't, it says that people are free to come and go. It doesn't acknowledge that the hole exists, or and there are other places that are called rehabilitation project forces, which are places where people are sent to go through some kind of re-education. The church claims that they're free to come and go.
Has anybody ever been arrested over this kind of confinement?
Not that I know of. I mean, I've asked the same questions that, you know, puzzle you and other people. You know, if you hear the stories of the abuse, you hear the stories of the of confinement, and you say, "Well, why didn't anybody call the police?" And the answer I get from Scientologists who've left the church is that our eternal salvation is essentially at stake. We have, you know, if you are a believing Scientologist, you think that Scientology is the answer. We are eternal beings, and yet we live and die in darkness. We have no idea of our eternal being as a thetan, as they call them, an eternal soul. And Scientology is the only true way of attaining that kind of knowledge, and to be excommunicated, thrown out, would be to lose that. And it's a powerful grip that is held on these people's imaginations.
So what made Paul Haggis finally leave the church? You wrote about not only his attraction to the content of Scientology, but you were describing his deep community ties, family and friends, mm-hmm. and so forth. And yet eventually he walked away.
What really triggered Paul was Proposition 8. If you recall, in 2008, there was a proposition on the California ballot that would prohibit gay marriage. One of the churches in San Diego, someone there, signed the church up as a supporter of that ballot initiative. Paul has three daughters. Two of them are gay. And one of the daughters told her father, she found out about this, and he was incensed. And he sent a note to Tommy Davis, the chief spokesperson of the church, saying, "Tommy, we have to take a stand against this. We have to renounce it," and so on. And Tommy responded over a period of time. They engaged in this lengthy email correspondence, saying that he would issue a statement saying that it was a mistake, that the church doesn't engage in political activities. Paul wasn't mollified. He wanted the church to take a stand against this. And essentially, the correspondence stopped for a while, and Davis and other members of the church must have believed that Paul had given up his interest. But what actually happened is he began, for the first time in more than three decades in the church, he began to look into some of the accusations that surround the Church of Scientology and have always been out there. But like many Scientologists, he had been discouraged from looking at these kinds of accusations. Scientologists are simply told not to look at them.
Is discouraged a nice way of saying intimidated?
You know, I think it's more subtle than that, Brian. I mean, I don't think that you would intimidate Paul Haggis in that way, but you're convinced after a while that the world stands against and doesn't understand Scientology, and that it's bad for your spiritual development to even look at this stuff, so don't. And I think it was more in that kind of mindset rather than someone saying you are not allowed to look at it. Although that does take place, I've heard that story. But I don't think that would have been applicable to Paul. He was just convinced as a Scientologist that it was that people didn't understand the religion and there was no point in looking at it.
Journalist Lawrence Wright, my guest on WNYC, his article in The New Yorker this week about Scientology. The church presented huge amounts of evidence refuting or claiming to refute every point you brought up.
That's correct.
In the article as you were writing this. And I couldn't help but notice that many of the anecdotes are parenthetically contradicted. Tom Cruise says X. Mimi Rogers, spokesperson or Scientologist official, denies it, even if they aren't crucial to a major plot point. And you're sitting in a room, we'll tell the listeners, with an employee or fact checker because you feel the need to be so dogged about not getting anything wrong. What are they going to do to you?
I have no idea. But I know that they are an organization that is aggressive and litigious and very concerned about their public image. And I don't want to get anything wrong either. Information that you're talking about, it was a fascinating day. I had met with Tommy Davis in California. He was supposed to take me through Scientology, and he essentially said that he wasn't going to talk to me. But he did agree to answer queries that we might put to the church. And we put 971 queries initially. And it elicited a storm of reaction. And eventually, Davis and his wife and four Scientology lawyers came to New York with 47 binders of supporting documents to refute the erroneous assumptions that they found in our queries. And we spent the entire day from 10 to 6 at night. That Scientology delegation plus me, two of our checkers. Eventually, we had five checkers on the story. The head of our fact-checking department, our lawyer, my editor, and David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, all in this room the entire day. It was an extraordinary day. And actually, from the point of view of our article and our efforts, very revelatory. We had a lot of questions answered, and not always to the church's advantage.
That's quite a story and quite an entourage, including David Remnick himself coming with you on this. You're one of the world's dogged investigative reporters. You've gone around the globe trying to trace the roots of Al-Qaeda, putting yourself at great risk in the process and going places where most people wouldn't even go, trying to get answers. You really want answers. At the end of the day, what are you left with as your biggest unanswered questions about Scientology?
Here's a question that is I'm struck with, and I don't have an answer yet because it has to do with, what would a Scientologist reading my article, how would they react? And, would it affect their decision to be affiliated with the church or not? I don't see the article necessarily as being an expose. Because let's face it, the church is a highly stigmatized organization already. Its numbers are probably in stark decline. They claim millions of members. But census figures just don't reflect that. I mean, it's a church with a lot of money and a lot of property and not that many members. But there are very serious adherents. So if I write an article which I think displays many of the weaknesses of the church, many of the fallacies of its origins, would that affect a person who is religiously oriented to it? I don't know. This is going to be the question in the next several months I'll be most eager to see the answer to.
Lawrence Wright. On his Scientology article in this week's New Yorker, we recorded that interview yesterday. If you want to see a photo of me and Lawrence Wright and his special assistant fact checker, you can see it on Twitter. We just tweeted it out, so go to Brian Lehrer on Twitter. Tomorrow, more with Lawrence Wright, based on his previous research on how Al-Qaeda was born largely in the prisons of Egypt. And coming up next, we will meet an 82-year-old civil rights hero who refused to ride in the back of the bus before Rosa Parks. And we are inviting calls right now on the civil rights heroes in your family. It's a Black History Month history call-in. Tell the story of your parents, your grandparents, or whoever, if you would call them civil rights heroes. And you can call us now at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692.